in the 11th hour, and his opponent, who had been on the board since 1927, had been so confident that he didn't even campaign. "I didn't think the people were ready for this," his opponent J.H. Landers told the Atlanta Constitution. The win made Clement the first colored man to win a major office in Georgia since Reconstruction, and was significant enough to merit a story in the New York Times and articles in Time and Newsweek. "For the first time since Reconstruction days," the Times wrote, "a Negro won nomination to Atlanta's Board of Education." The news filtered back as Robert was knocking on doors collecting urine samples and still boarding with the Becks. He was feeling even more isolated and alone, and could not let on to anyone back home the truth of his situation. Just as he was needing to muster more faith than ever, the South chose a rare instance to let slip a colored victory, and to President Clement, no less, the man who had never thought Robert measured up, who had taken over his role as the head of his own family, and who second-guessed his every decision, even his choice to leave the South. Robert was struggling with that choice at that very moment, and now could not escape his father-in-law's triumph, because it was national news. Robert was now feeling the accumulated weight of all the pressure he was under. With the Clements unwittingly gaining a greater hold on Alice and the girls, as President Clement rose in stature, Robert fretted over his options. He had to get himself established, and soon. He devised a new plan to gain a foothold in Los Angeles. He now decided to canvass positions door to door to try to build up referrals. He would market himself at the big middle-class churches in town. He would court potential patients wherever he could and dress in such a way that they wouldn't forget him. So in between insurance exams, he went from building to building, office to office, up and down Jefferson Avenue and off Vermont and Figueroa, tracking down physicians like a homeless man looking for change. He knocked on glass doors with a doctor's name etched on them as he dreamed his too would be one day. He sucked in his pride and took in a deep breath and tried introducing himself to physicians who knew or thought little of him to get into their good graces. He showed them his surgery credentials and asked if they wouldn't mind referring cases to him if they didn't do surgery themselves. "That was met with poor success," Robert said. Here he was, a perfect stranger from someplace down south, Louisiana, was it, asking for a favor. The big city doctors who happened to beat him to California or had grown up there didn't take to it kindly. "So you took a lump in the jaw and kept on to the next office." He made his pitch again and again and got the same response. "All the cordiality in the world," Robert said. They would say, "I've been using Dr. XYZ for all these years. Show me one good reason I should change to you." He didn't have an answer then, but he was determined that one day he would. So he set about trying to make a name for himself the best he knew how. He started going to churches, even though he was rarely seen in them otherwise. He decided to put on his loudest, most ostentatious suit and tie, so the people would remember him. He made a show of dropping more than he really could afford when the collection plate came his way, enough for the church people to be sure to notice. He asked the ministers if they would introduce him to their congregations from the pulpit, as they did politicians and visitors from back south. "I didn't have any responses," he said. But Golden State Insurance kept sending him out, and those after-hours insurance examinations were adding up. So he decided to turn his attention to the people themselves. He was doing more and more of those exams, and the anonymous working-class colored people of South Central L.A., many newly arrived from Texas or Arkansas or parts of Louisiana that Robert did not know, began to notice this smooth-talking physician who looked more like a high roller than a doctor in his loud tailored suits and stingy brim hats, who made you feel as though you were the most important person in the world. He conducted enough of those examinations and collected enough of those critical vials of urine to move into an apartment west of Crenshaw, near the Becks. He had been in Los Angeles a couple of months, getting himself set up, and could send for Alice and the girls now. His name was now forming on the lips of cleaning ladies and laborers, gamblers and seamstresses, postal workers and stevedores scattered all over South Central who wanted a doctor they could relate to, the humble and exuberant people who would eventually become the foundation of everything he would ever do in Los Angeles, and among the most loyal people ever to enter his life. Divisions. I walked to the elevator and rode down with Shorty. "You lucky bastard," he said bitterly. "Why do you say that? You saved your goddamn money and now you're gone. My problems are just starting." Richard Wright, Black Boy, American Hunger. The North and West, 1915 to the 1970s. Unknowingly, the migrants were walking into a headwind of resentment and suspicion. They could not hide the rough-cast clothes ill-suited for northern winters, or the slow syrup accent some northerners could not decipher. They carried with them the scents of the South, of lye soap and earthen field. They had emerged from a cave of restrictions into wide-open anonymous hives that viewed them with bemusement and contempt. They had been trained to walk humbly, look down when spoken to. It would take time to learn the ways of the North. What they could not have realized was the calcifying untruths they would have to overcome on top of everything else. As soon as the North took note of the flood of colored people from the South, sociologists and economists began studying the consequences of their arrival and drawing conclusions about who these people were and why they were coming. "With few exceptions," wrote the economist Sadie Moselle of the migration to Philadelphia, "the migrants were untrained, often illiterate, and generally void of culture. The inarticulate and resigned masses came to the city," wrote the preeminent sociologist E. Franklin Frazier of the 1930s migration to Chicago, adding that "the disorganization of Negro life in the city seems at times to be a disease." In 1965, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then an official in the U.S. Department of Labor, called the inner cities after the arrival of the southern migrants a tangle of pathology. He argued that what had attracted southerners like Ida Mae, George, and Robert was welfare. "The differential in payments between jurisdictions has to encourage some migration toward urban centers in the North," he wrote, adding his own italics. Their reputation had preceded them. It had not been good. Neither was it accurate. The general laws of migration hold that the greater the obstacles and the farther the distance traveled, the more ambitious the migrants. It is the higher status segments of a population which are most residentially mobile. The sociologists Carl and Alma Tauber wrote in a 1965 analysis of census data on the migrants, published the same year as the Moynihan Report. "As the distance of migration increases," wrote the migration scholar Everett Lee, "the migrants become an increasingly superior group." Any migration takes some measure of energy, planning, and forethought. It requires not only the desire for something better, but the willingness to act on that desire to achieve it. Thus, the people who undertake such a journey are more likely to be either among the better educated of their homes of origin, or those most motivated to make it in the new world, researchers have found. Migrants who overcome a considerable set of intervening obstacles do so for compelling reasons, and such migrations are not taken lightly, Lee wrote. Intervening obstacles serve to weed out some of the weak or the incapable. The South had erected some of the highest barriers to migration of any people seeking to leave one place for another in this country. By the time the migrants made it out, they were likely willing to do whatever it took to make it, so as not to have to return south and admit defeat. It would be decades before census data could be further analyzed and bear out these observations. One myth they had to overcome was that they were bedraggled hayseeds just off the plantation. Census figures paint a different picture. By the 1930s, nearly 2 out of every 3 colored migrants to the big cities of the North and West were coming from towns or cities in the South, as did George Starling and Robert Foster, rather than straight from the field. The move to northern cities was dominated by urban Southerners, wrote the scholar J. Trent Alexander. Thus, the latter wave of migrants brought a higher level of sophistication than was assumed at the time. Most Negro migrants to northern metropolitan areas have had considerable previous experience with urban living, the Tauber study observed. Overall, Southern migrants represented the most educated segment of the Southern black population they left, the sociologist Stuart Tolney wrote in 1998. In 1940 and 1950, colored people who left the South averaged nearly 2 more years of completed schooling than those who remained in the South. That middle wave of migrants found themselves, on average, more than 2 years behind the blacks they encountered in the North. But by the 1950s, those numbers would change. As the migration matured, the migrants would arrive with higher levels of education than earlier waves of migrants, and thus greater employment potential than both the blacks they left behind and the blacks they joined. A 1965 study of 94 migrants to Chicago, most of them from Mississippi and Arkansas, found that 13% were illiterate, defined as having 5 or fewer years of schooling, compared to 45% of the people in the southern counties they came from. The migrants and the blacks they encountered in the poor West Side neighborhood of North Lawndale had roughly the same amount of schooling, an average of about 8 years, the study found. There is no support, the sociologist Frank T. Cherry wrote, for the notion of a less well-educated pool of migrants entering Chicago than it already has. A seminal study that would be published that same year went even further. Across the North as a whole, the post-World War II migrants were not of lower average socioeconomic status than the resident Negro population, the Taubers wrote in their 1965 census analysis of migrants arriving North from 1955 to 1960. Indeed, in educational attainment, Negro in-migrants to northern cities were equal to or slightly higher than the resident white population. Against nearly every assumption about the migration, the 1965 census study found that the migrants of the 1950s, particularly those who came from towns and cities, as had George Starling and Robert Foster, had more education than even the northern white population they joined. The percentage of post-war black migrants who had graduated from high school was as high as or higher than that of native whites in New York, Cleveland, Philadelphia, and St. Louis, and close to the percentage of whites in Chicago. As for blacks who had the advantage of having come from the urban South, the percentage who had graduated from high school was higher than that of the whites they joined, by significant margins in some cases, in each of the 7 northern cities the study examined. In Philadelphia, for instance, some 39% of the blacks who had migrated from towns or cities had graduated from high school, compared with 33% of the native whites. In Cleveland, 40% of migrants from the urban South were high school graduates, compared to 31% of the native whites. This was the case for George Starling, Robert Foster, and hundreds of thousands of other colored migrants from the small town South, who, it turns out, often had as much as or more education than those they met, colored or white, in the cities to which they fled, though they were often looked down upon. Indeed, when it came to their black counterparts, the Tauber study found that in every major city the migrants fled to, a higher percentage of migrants had completed at least 1 year of high school than the black population they joined. 61% of migrants, compared to 53% of native blacks in New York. 56% of migrants, compared to 52% of native blacks in Chicago. 63% of migrants, compared to 54% of native blacks in Cleveland. 66% of migrants, compared to 54% of black natives in Washington, D.C. 60% of migrants, compared to 48% of native blacks in Philadelphia, and so on. The migrants, the Taubers found, resemble in educational levels the whites among whom they live, and they tended to be of substantially higher socioeconomic status on the average than the resident Negro population. The researchers added that these findings are at variance with most previous discussions of Negro migration. The misconceptions about the migrants carried over to their presumed behavior upon arrival. Contrary to popular convention, the migrants were more likely to be married and remain married, less likely to bear children out of wedlock, and less likely to head single-parent households than the black northerners they encountered at their destinations. They were more likely to be employed, and due to their willingness to work longer hours or more than one job, they actually earned more as a group than their northern black counterparts, despite being relegated to the lowliest positions. Black men who have been out of the South for 5 years or more are, in every instance, more likely to be in the labor force than other black men in the North, wrote Larry H. Long and Lynn R. Heltman of the Census Bureau in 1975. They found that among young black men in the North, 15% of those born in the North were jobless, as against 9% of the Southern migrants they studied. The same pattern applies to all other age groups and to the West, the census found. Whatever their educational level, the migrants more successfully avoided poverty, wrote Long and his colleague Kristen A. Hansen of the Census Bureau, because of higher rates of labor force participation and other unmeasured characteristics. There developed several theories as to why. One was that because the migrants' hard laboring lives in the South, they had a stronger attachment to the labor force as a result of their work-oriented values, Long and Hansen wrote. Another explanation pointed to disadvantages facing the northern-born blacks in the migrants' destinations. Exposure to drugs, crime, and other conditions in big cities that may be handicaps in obtaining and holding jobs. There is yet another possible reason, that the migrants who would make it out of the South and outlast others who gave up and returned home were a particularly resilient group of survivors. The migration of blacks out of the South has clearly been selective of the best educated, Long and Hansen wrote. It is possible that the least capable returned, leaving in the North a very able and determined group of migrants. Those who would tough it out in the North and West were not willing to risk relocation in the South because of possible greater advantages in their current location, wrote the sociologists Won Long Lee and Sharon L. Randolph in a 1982 study of the migrants. This would suggest that the people of the Great Migration, who ultimately made lives for themselves in the North and West, were among the most determined of those in the South, among the most resilient of those who left, and among the most resourceful of blacks in the North, not unlike immigrant groups from other parts of the world who made a way for themselves in the big cities of the North and West. There appeared to be an overarching phenomenon that sociologists call a migrant advantage. It is some internal resolve that perhaps exists in any immigrant compelled to leave one place for another. It made them especially goal-oriented, leading them to persist in their work and not be easily discouraged, Long and Heltman of the Census Bureau wrote in a 1975 report. In San Francisco, for instance, the migrants doubled up like their Chinese counterparts and, as in other cities, tended to immigrate as groups and to remain together in the new environment for purposes of mutual aid, wrote the sociologist Charles S. Johnson. The willingness to do whatever it took to survive appeared to offer some protection from the ills surrounding them, North and South. The San Francisco study found that the migrants were half as likely to be separated, divorced, or widowed as the blacks they encountered upon arrival. Overall, wherever they went, they tended to be more family stable compared both to those they left behind at their origin and those they encountered at their destination, the sociologist Thomas Wilson wrote in 2001. They are less likely to bear children outside of marriage and less likely to be divorced or separated from their spouses. The findings, he wrote, are once again clearly at odds with earlier claims that family dysfunction was carried north by southern migrants. Still, the stereotypes persisted despite the evidence and extended to even the youngest migrants. The children, having emerged from one-room schoolhouses with their southern English, were often labeled retarded by northern school officials, regardless of their native abilities. Segregation was not the law, but northerners would find creative ways to segregate the migrant children from the white children when so inclined. Colored pupils sometimes occupy only the front seats or the back seats, wrote the researcher W. A. Daniel in 1928. They are grouped on one side or occupy alternate rows. Sometimes they are seated without regard to race, or they share seats with white pupils, a method used regularly by one teacher for punishing white pupils. The absurdities of the South seem to follow the migrants north despite their efforts to escape. One migrant child faced altogether different seating and circumstances in each classroom he entered. In this case, the student, Daniel wrote, is literally forced to take the back seat in one classroom. In another room, he is the president of his class and in another, the editor of the paper, in another, in charge of the tool room, while in another he is expected to do more than his share of menial tasks. It was in the early 1920s that a little boy named James Cleveland Owens migrated with his sharecropper parents from Oakville, Alabama, to Cleveland, Ohio, when he was 9 years old. The city of Cleveland was the promised land to colored people in his part of Alabama, as reflected by his middle name. The parents had debated for months over whether to leave, the mother anxious to do so, the father having been beaten down by sharecropping, worried and fearful. As they prepared to leave, the little boy happened to bump into his father while they were packing for the train. The father put both hands on his son's shoulders to steady himself, but quickly removed them out of embarrassment. Only then did the boy realize that his father's hands were shaking with fright. The boy's first day of school in the North, he was assigned to a grade lower than the one he'd been in where he had come from, and the teacher couldn't understand his southern accent. When she asked him his name, he said he was called J.C. The teacher misheard him, and from that day forward called him Jesse instead. So did everyone else in this new world he was in. He would forever be known as Jesse Owens, not by his given name. He would go on to win 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, becoming the first American in the history of track and field to do so in a single Olympics, and disproving the Aryan notions of his Nazi hosts. It made headlines throughout the United States that Adolf Hitler, who had watched the races, had refused to shake hands with Owens, as he had with white medalists. But Owens found that in Nazi Germany, he had been able to stay in the same quarters and eat with his white teammates, something he could not do in his home country. Upon his return, there was a ticker tape parade in New York. Afterward, he was forced to ride the freight elevator to his own reception at the Waldorf Astoria. "I wasn't invited to shake hands with Hitler," he wrote in his autobiography, "but I wasn't invited to the White House to shake hands with the president either. I came back to my native country, and I could not ride in the front of the bus. I had to go to the back door. I couldn't live where I wanted. Now, what's the difference?" It would take the arrival of millions of more migrants and many more decades of perseverance on their part and on the part of protesters for human rights before they would truly become accepted. But his father, a man of few words who had come north with the greatest reluctance and worry, was overcome with the enormity of the moment and how it had come to be. His son had had the chance to go to good schools, run on real tracks, and be coached at Ohio State University, rather than spend his life picking cotton. "My son's victories in Germany," Henry Owen said, "force me to realize that I made the best move of my life by moving out of the South." Chicago, August 1938. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. Miss Theney had been right about her daughter. Ida Mae was expecting when she left Mississippi with her husband and two little ones in the fall of 1937. That spring, she returned south for the express purpose of having the baby in the familiar hands of a midwife. She had heard that up north, doctors strapped women down when they went into labor, and she wasn't going to submit to that kind of barbarity. So she gave birth to her last child in Miss Theney's house on May 28, 1938. It was a baby girl, and Ida Mae named her Eleanor, like the first lady of the land, Eleanor Roosevelt. She kept the baby in Mississippi until she was plump and strong, and then carried her and little James and Velma north on the Illinois Central sometime in August to rejoin her husband. Only this time, Ida Mae didn't return to Milwaukee. She got off in Chicago, the city of skyscrapers and Montgomery Ward that she had thought was heaven when she first set foot in the North. While she was away giving birth, George had left Milwaukee, having found little work and given up on the prospects of making a living there. One of his brothers had settled in Chicago, so George turned to the bigger city with its steel mills, blast furnaces, slaughterhouses, and tanneries. He would have been willing to take just about anything to feed his family, having stooped to pick cotton all his life. But what he found first was a job on another man's ice wagon. Up and down the rutted streets they went, steering the horse and wagon in the early morning hours, delivering ice to the colored people in their cold water flats on the south side. "Ice man! Ice man!" they shouted as they steered. "Bring me 50 pounds. Someone would yell from the window of a three-flat. "Bring me 100, came an order from another. George slung a rug across his shoulders and hoisted a block of ice on his back to carry it up the tenement steps. He was used to hauling 100 pounds of cotton in a day for 50 cents. Now he could make that with each 50-pound block of ice. And he was delivering a lot of it. Ice melted fast in the summer heat. Some people needed to replenish their ice boxes every day. He was already making more money than in Mississippi, and not under the shotgun scrutiny of a planter. It was stoop labor, and he couldn't do it forever, but it would have to do for now. By the time Ida Mae got back with the baby and little James and Velma, he had secured for his family a one-room basement apartment among the frail tenements and dilapidated lean-tos in the roped-off colored section of town. It was a kitchenette in a two-flat in the low 40s off St. Lawrence. Preceding waves of European immigrants had lived there before them in creaking buildings from the 19th century, the streets now pockmarked and piled so high with rubbish that ice wagons couldn't get through some of them. It was only a few miles south, but a world away from the boulevards and skyscrapers Ida Mae had seen when she first arrived, gray and weed-strewn as this new place of hers was. They were confined to a little isthmus on the south side of Chicago that came to be called Bronzeville, the Black Belt, North Mississippi. It was a narrow tongue of land, 7 miles in length and 1.5 miles in width, as the mid-century historians St. Clair, Drake, and Horace Caton described it, where 250,000 colored people were packed on top of one another by the time Ida Mae and her family arrived. Up and down Indiana and Wabash and Prairie and South Parkway, across 22nd Street and down to 31st and 39th and into the low 40s, a colored world, a city within a city, rolled out from the sidewalks, the streets aflutter with grocers and undertakers, dressmakers and barber shops, tailors and pressers, dealers of coal and sellers of firewood, insurance agents and real estate men, pharmacists and newspapers, a YMCA and the Urban League, high-steepled churches, Baptist, Holiness, African Methodist Episcopal churches practically transported from Mississippi and Arkansas, and stacked-heeled harlots stumbling out of call houses and buffet flats. There were temptations a southern sharecropper couldn't have known existed, and that could only catch root when so many people were packed into one place, the police could be bought, and the city looked away. Reefer pads, card sharks, gangsters, and crapshooters. The so-called mulatto queen of the underworld running poker games. Policy kings running the numbers racket, ready to take a migrant's newly earned dollar fresh from the slaughterhouse. The migrants could see Ma Rainey at the Regal, or just melt into the neon anonymity of city life without a watchful uncle or jack-leg preacher knowing about it. This was the landing place in Chicago for most colored people just in from the South. They had left the wide-open spaces and gravel roads of the cotton fields and had to watch their every step. Ida Mae, and George in particular, pious and churchly as he was, wanted nothing to do with the devilment crowding in on them, but had to make the best of it and just be thankful for having made it out of Mississippi alive. By the time Ida Mae and her family arrived, Chicago was a major terminus of the great migration of colored people out of the South and of latter-day immigrants from Central and Eastern Europe. It had first been settled in 1779 by a black man named Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable in what was then Wilderness. He was a fur trader who built a rude cabin on the sandpoint at the mouth of the river. Ida Mae found the living conditions not much better than those back home, and in some cases worse. A few goats and an occasional pig roamed alleyways that reeked of rotting vermin. Front doors hung on single hinges. The sun peeked through cracks in the outer walls. Many rooms sat airless and windowless, packed with so many people that some roomers had to sleep in shifts, all of which made a mockery of city codes devised to protect against these very things. Families lived without light, without heat, and sometimes without water, observed Edith Abbott, a University of Chicago researcher who studied tenement life in Chicago in the 1930s, the time when Ida Mae arrived. The misery of housing conditions at this time can scarcely be exaggerated. They were living in virtual slave cabins stacked on top of one another, wives like Ida Mae cooking on hot plates and hanging their laundry out the window, if they had a window at all, unable to protect themselves or their children from the screams and conversation and sugar talk and fighting all around them. It was as if all of them were living in one room without space for their own thoughts or for their dreams of how best to get out. Ida May soon discovered that there really was no getting out, not right off, anyway. Negro migrants confronted a solid wall of prejudice and labored under great disadvantages in these attempts to find new homes, Abbott wrote. The color line in Chicago confined them to a sliver of the least desirable blocks between the Jewish lakefront neighborhoods to the east and the Irish strongholds to the west, while the Poles, Russians, Italians, Lithuanians, Czechs, and Serbs, who had only recently arrived themselves, were planting themselves to the southwest of the colored district. With several thousand black Southerners arriving each month in the receiving cities of the North, and no extra room being made for them, attics and cellars, storerooms and basements, churches, sheds, and warehouses, according to Abraham Epstein in his study of the early migration, were converted to contain all the new arrivals. There was rarely a place in these rooms for even suitcases or trunks. People like Ida May had few options, and the landlords knew it. New arrivals often paid twice the rent charged the whites they had just replaced for worn-out and ill-kept housing. The rents in the Southside Negro District were conspicuously the highest of all districts visited, Abbott wrote. Dwellings that went for $8 to $20 a month to white families were bringing $12 to $45 a month from black families, those earning the least income, and thus least able to afford a flat at any rent in the early stages of the migration. Thus began a pattern of overcharging and underinvestment in black neighborhoods that would lay the foundation for decades of economic disparities in the urban North. Ida May tried never to worry about things she couldn't change, and so made do with what they could get. She wasn't the only one. Lodgers were not disposed to complain about the living conditions or the prices charged, Epstein wrote. They were only too glad to secure a place where they could share a half or at least a part of an unclaimed bed. The story played out in virtually every northern city. Migrants sealed off in overcrowded colonies that would become the foundation for ghettos that would persist into the next century. These were the original colored quarters, the abandoned and identifiable no-man's lands that came into being when the least paid people were forced to pay the highest rents for the most dilapidated housing owned by absentee landlords trying to wring the most money out of a place nobody cared about. It would soon come to be that anyone living in any American city would know exactly where these forgotten islands were, if only to make sure to avoid them. Under the viaduct along a polluted stream in Akron, Ohio, in the Hill District in Pittsburgh, Roxbury in Boston, the east side of Cincinnati, the near east side of Detroit, nearly all of East St. Louis, whole swaths of the south side of Chicago and south central in Los Angeles, and much of Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant in New York. Like other migrants with limited options, Ida May and her family moved from place to place, from one unacceptable flat to a slightly larger and less odious option a few blocks away, not unlike sharecroppers moving from farm to farm, looking for a less exploitive arrangement with, they hoped, a fairer planter. Soon they were living on the top floor of a three-flat at 36th and Wabash. It was well into the Great Depression, and a man took to sleeping at odd hours of the day on the little landing outside their kitchen door. "I opened the door and put garbage out there, and he still be asleep," Ida May remembered. "I don't know who he was. He stayed there winter and summer. He didn't bother nobody. He was sleeping like he was in a bed. He had his little cover out there." "Did he ever wake up when you went out there?" I asked her once. "No," she said, "because I reckon he done did his devilment all night." Ida May didn't know it, but with the Great Depression deepening, she and her family had arrived in a city unprepared for and utterly resistant to the continuing influx of migrants. city fathers and labor experts had expected the Great Migration to end with World War I. Jobs and housing were scarcer now. White unions were refusing colored workers membership, keeping colored wages low, restricting the work that migrants could do, and leaving them unprotected during cutbacks. The colored old-timers who were already there were not especially happy to see them. Even as the migration was a bonanza for colored storekeepers and businessmen, it meant more competition for the already limited kinds of jobs blacks were allotted and made the black presence in the city more conspicuous and threatening to the city's racial alchemy. As it was, the city was still recovering from the tensions of one of the worst race riots in American history. The riots had set the city on edge and hardened race lines that would persist for generations. The trouble began after an incident only blocks from the 3 flat at 36th and Wabash, where Ida Mae's family would live exactly 2 decades later. It was the summer of 1919. World War I, the stimulus of the first wave of the Great Migration, was over. Munitions plants had shut down. The factories that lured black Southerners were now letting workers go. The country was on the verge of recession, not able even to imagine the actual depression that was brewing. The migrants, hemmed in and living on top of one another, even as more of them arrived, pressed against the white neighborhoods on their borders and were met with death threats and bombings when they ventured to the other side. The demilitarized zone was a moving target that no one could see, but that everyone knew in his bones. Blacks were finding more things off-limits than it would otherwise appear, defined by custom and whites' discomfort, rather than by law. Even the beaches of Lake Michigan were segregated. Everyone was feeling the strain of a declining economy. Whites saw the migrants as competition for a scarcer pool of jobs and took to attacking them along the western boundary of the Black Belt. Then on Sunday, July 27th, 1919, a 17-year-old black boy named Eugene Williams, swimming along the shore of Lake Michigan, drifted past an invisible line in the lake into the white side of the 29th Street beach. As was common in the North, there were no white or colored signs. It was merely understood that whites entered and used the beach at 29th Street, and blacks were to stay near the 27th Street entrance, 2 blocks north. The imaginary color line stretched out into the water. Swimming as he was, the boy couldn't see the line where the white water began, because the water looked the same. Carl Sandburg, the future poet who was then a reporter for the Chicago Daily News, recounted it this way. A colored boy swam across an imaginary segregation line. White boys threw rocks at him and knocked him off a raft. He was drowned. Blacks demanded that the white police officer on the scene arrest the whites they said had hurled rocks at Williams. The officer refused, arresting instead a black man in the crowd on a white man's complaint. Within hours, tensions reached a boil on both sides, and a riot was in full cry. Whites dragged black passengers from streetcars and beat them. Blacks stabbed a white peddler and a white laundryman to death. 2 white men were killed walking through a black neighborhood, and 2 black men were killed walking through a white neighborhood. White gangs stormed the Black Belt, setting houses on fire, hunting down black residents, firing shotguns, and hurling bricks. All told, the riots coursed through the south and southwest sides of the city for 13 days, killing 38 people, 23 blacks and 15 whites, and injuring 537 others, 342 blacks, 178 whites, the rest unrecorded, and not ending until a state militia subdued them. Contrary to modern-day assumptions, for much of the history of the United States, from the draft riots of the 1860s to the violence over desegregation a century later, riots were often carried out by disaffected whites against groups perceived as threats to their survival. Thus, riots would become, to the North, what lynchings were to the South, each a display of uncontained rage by put-upon people directed toward the scapegoats of their condition. Nearly every big northern city experienced one or more during the 20th century. Each outbreak pitted two groups that had more in common with each other than either of them realized. Both sides were made up of rural and small-town people who had traveled far in search of the American dream, both relegated to the worst jobs by industrialists who pitted one group against the other. Each side was struggling to raise its families in a cold, fast, alien place far from their homelands, and looked down upon by the earlier, more sophisticated arrivals. They were essentially the same people except for the color of their skin, and many of them arrived into these anonymous receiving stations at around the same time, one set against the other, and unable to see the commonality of their mutual plight. Thus these violent clashes bore the futility of Greek tragedy. Yet the situation was even more complicated than the black migrants could have imagined. As they made their way north, so did some of the poorer whites from the South, looking not for freedom from persecution, but for greater economic rewards for their hard work. Slavery and sharecropping, along with the ravages of the boll weevil and floods, had depressed the wages of every worker in the South. The call of the North drew some of the Southern whites the migrants had sought to escape. Initially, they came to the North in greater numbers, but they were much more likely to return South than colored Southerners were. Fewer than half of all white Southerners who left actually stayed in the North for good, thus behaving more like classic migrant workers than immigrants. Still, many brought their prejudices with them and melted into the white working-class world of ethnic immigrants to make a potent advance guard against black inroads in the North. As a window into their sentiments, a witness to the Detroit riots in 1943 gave this description of a white mob that had attacked colored people in that outbreak. By the conversation of the men gathered there, I was able to detect that they were Southerners and that they resented Negroes working beside them and receiving the same amount of money, the informant said, adding that these Southern whites believed that the black migrants ought to be taken down a peg or two. Perhaps the earliest indication of what the migrants were unknowingly up against came from an outbreak directly related to the Great Migration, or rather to how the North reacted to the newcomers from the South. These were the riots that erupted in East St. Louis, Illinois, in the summer of 1917, after companies being struck by white workers hired colored migrants to replace them. The migrants were flocking to the city at a rate of 1,000 a month, some 18,000 having arrived that spring, and they instantly became the perfect pawns, an industrialist's dream. They were desperate to leave the South, anxious for work, untutored in union politics or workers' rights, as most could not have imagined unionizing themselves as field hands, thus uncomprehending of the idea of a worker making demands, and unlikely to complain about whatever conditions they might face. Once the strike was over, the colored migrants, resented by the unions and unprotected by the plants that had hired them, paid the price. One union wrote its members that the immigration of the Southern Negro into our city for the past 8 months has reached a point where drastic action must be taken, and demanded that the city retard this growing menace and devise a way to get rid of a certain portion of those who are already here. On the night of July 1st, a carload of whites fired shots into colored homes. The colored residents fired back when a second car filled with whites passed through, killing two policemen. The next day, full-scale rioting began. Colored men were stabbed, clubbed, and hanged from telephone poles. A colored 2-year-old was shot and thrown into the doorway of a burning building. A black skin was a death warrant on the streets of this Illinois city, wrote an observer shortly afterward. The police, charged with quelling the riot, in some cases joined in, as did some in the state militia sent in to restore order, actions that resulted in 7 courts-martial. All told, 39 blacks and 8 whites were killed, more than 100 blacks were shot or maimed, and 5,000 blacks were driven from their homes. After the 2 riots, city leaders in Chicago could see no end to the racial divisions without intervention and a public appeal for tolerance. A white-led biracial commission set up to investigate the climate and circumstances leading to the riots produced a 672-page report, The Negro in Chicago. It stands to this day as one of the most comprehensive examinations of both the early stages of the Great Migration and race relations in a Northern American city. With a sense of urgency, it set out 59 recommendations for improving race relations. It urged that the police rid the city's colored section of the vice and prostitution that plagued the Black Belt, that the schools hire principals with an interest in promoting good race relations, that white citizens seek accurate information about blacks as a basis of their judgments, that restaurants, stores, and theaters stop segregating when they weren't supposed to, that companies deal with Negroes as workmen on the same plane as white workers and stop using them as strikebreakers and denying them apprenticeships, that labor unions admit colored workers when they qualified, that employers permit Negroes an equal chance with whites to enter all positions for which they are qualified by efficiency and merit, that the press avoid using epithets in referring to blacks and treat black stories and white stories with the same standards and sense of proportion. With the commission having no authority to enforce its recommendations, and a good portion of the citizenry not likely even to have seen them, much of its counsel went unheeded. So Ida May arrived in a world that was perhaps even tenser than before the riots. In the ensuing decades, the color line would only stiffen. The South Side would become almost totally black, and the North Side almost totally white. Ida May's adopted home would become one of the most racially divided of all American cities, and remain so for the rest of the 20th century. New York, summer 1945, George Swanson Starling. George finally brought Inez to New York in June of 1945 to begin life on their own for the first time in their marriage. Now that he had a decent job on the railroad, he was hoping she could now get a job as a beautician like she had trained for, and they could make a go of it in New York. But Inez was still nursing a grudge over how little time they had spent together since they had been married, how he'd gone off to Detroit without her, how he had taken so long to send for her, and now, here he was, likely to be gone half the time working the rails. He was always the one with big dreams, and he had them now. He wanted to make up for all they didn't have and couldn't have back in Florida. He located a little beauty shop around the corner from the brownstone where they lived that had 6 available booths for her to use. "Inez, this is your chance," he told her. "We can rent this place, and you can do hair in one booth and rent out the other 5 booths. You can build you up a business here, and then after a while, you don't have to do no hair at all, just supervise." But Inez wasn't of a mind to do much of what he said, given all they had been through, so she decided to forego hairdressing after all. She would never work at it a day in her life. Instead, she took a short nursing course and got a job at a hospital to show her independence, despite him, or both. George had escaped Florida, but he could not run away from the frustrations of an impulsive, ill-advised marriage. Inez had arrived in Harlem, but nothing had changed. They were getting along no better than before. So when he wasn't on the rails, he began to fall under Harlem's spell, like many of the new arrivals suddenly free of the South. Between the people he knew from back in Florida and the co-workers he met riding the rails, he had a ready-made set of diversions every night of the week in a place that never shut down and was spilling over with people. It was said that Harlem was one of the most crowded places in all of the country. Some 500,000 colored people were crammed into a sliver of Upper Manhattan that was about 50 blocks long and only 7 or 8 blocks wide. A 1924 study by the National Urban League confirmed what colored tenants already knew, that colored renters paid from 40 to 60% higher rents than white tenants for the same class of apartment. So colored people in Harlem took in boarders and worked second and third jobs. Beginning in World War I, as many as 7,000 people were estimated to be living in a single block in Harlem. The crush of people begging for space forced rents even higher in what became a landlord's paradise. Cash-strapped renters looked for new ways to make their rent. They began throwing end-of-the-month parties where they drank bathtub gin, ate pig knuckles, and danced with the lights off, as Arna Bontemps wrote. They called them rent parties. They charged 25 cents admission for a few hours of smoke-hazed, gin-juiced, tom-tom caterwauling and poker playing with people from back home and with worldly-wise northerners they did not know, just to help make that month's rent. Up and down the side streets off Lenox and 7th Avenues, people flung open their apartment doors the Saturday night before the rent was due. They served pork chops and pig's feet and potato salad, just like down south, except that the food and spirits were for sale, and they put Count Basie on the record player to give people something to dance to. Total strangers looking for a good time could stroll down the block looking for a red, pink, or blue light in a window and listening for the rabble of a rent party in progress. Signs went up inviting anybody willing to pay. One read, "There'll be brown-skinned mamas, high yallas too, and if you ain't got nothing to do, come on up to Roy and Sadie's, West 126th Street, Saturday night, May 12th. There'll be plenty of pig feet and lots of gin. Just ring the bell and come on in." Tenants stood to make the most money if they got the partygoers playing poker, and George was all for it. There were some people from Eustis, Florida, living up on 7th Avenue between 146th and 147th Streets. They lived right next door to each other and started running their parties simultaneously. "We just go from one house to the other," George said. "We get tired of playing over to Freeman's, or we get mad with him about something, and we go over to MB's. We go from one house to the other. We would be gambling the whole weekend." When they got tired of the people on 7th Avenue, they went over to the Bronx, where the Bly brothers had a sister named Henry living over at 3rd Avenue and 17th Street, and played some more. The wives and girlfriends served the gin and bourbon and the grits and eggs and biscuits and smoked pork from the pork store down the street, the big poker players never getting up from the table, shoveling forkfuls of grits into their mouths between hands. They were playing five-card stud, and sometimes there were so many people there'd be 2 or 3 games running. People just in or visiting from Eustis and Ocala, people who had been in Harlem for years, hustlers who made a life out of circulating at the gambling tables of the rent parties to beat the tenants out of their own rent money. It was an open invitation, after all. George saw the money they were making. Some of them were pulling in hundreds of dollars a weekend, and decided to throw some parties himself. He went in with his friend Babe Bly, one of the Bly brothers from back home in Florida. There were 9 brothers in all, plus 3 girls that the parents had given boys' names to. But that's another story. Babe was working as an auto painter for General Motors in New York, and was living upstairs from George and Inez in the brownstone George was buying. Sometimes Inez served food, sometimes she wouldn't. Sometimes she would stay down in their apartment. Working the rails mostly for tips, George could use the extra money for the house note and went in with Babe to run some poker parties. George figured out the system. If you stay out of the game, and if you run a game for 4 or 5 hours or more, you're going to have most of the money, George said. You're going to have most of the money and the cut, because most of the players are going to lose. Trouble was, Babe couldn't just sit back and watch. "See, that was our weakness," George said. "Babe couldn't stay out of the game. He just had to get in the game, and he'd lose pretty near everything that we take in. Like most migrants from the South, George had surrounded himself with the people he knew from back in the old country. But the old country was still in the people, no matter where they went. And George found that as much as he loved the people from back home, he could never truly move up with the country.